Welcome to What Are You Sporting About Podcast, a podcast about business, employment, sports, and entertainment to help educate, support, and guide you to your next level. Here's your host, attorney Savania DeBarros.
Hey, 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 welcome to What Are You Sporting About Podcast. I am your host, Savania DeBarros, the protector of athletes. I'm also the founder and principal attorney of S.L. DeBarros Law Firm, where we represent six and seven figure entrepreneurs, employees, and athletes in business, employment, sports, and entertainment. Today, I have the honor of sitting down with Dr. Gregory Charlotte. And before we go into it, I just want to give you a little bit of background on him. Dr. Gregory Charlotte improves the lives of retired athletes, pros, and amateurs with high-performance wellness solutions. His solutions include expert advice on diet, nutrition, sleep, supplements, and mental health. Dr. Greg has been featured on ABC, NBC, CBS, and Fox, and he's the founder of Retired Athlete Health and the author of Why Doctors Skip Breakfast, Wellness Tips to Reverse Aging, Treat Depression, and Get a Good Night's Sleep. Welcome to the show, Doc.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on. It's great to be here.
So I'm so honored that you've agreed to jump on with me. So let's just jump right in. What does the question, what are you sporting about, mean to you?
Well, you know, I think a lot of people haven't fully realized this yet, but you have a lot of control over your health and your career and your destiny, but you have to make a conscious decision. So to me, when you say, what are you sporting about? It's like, where are you deciding to go with your life? Where are you going with your career? Where are you deciding to go on the field and off the field? Where are you going with your health? You get to make a decision and you want to head. You need to choose where you're heading and you need to head that way.
I love that answer. So this is the first medical type answer for what he's sporting about. And I love it because it's so important. And a lot of people don't realize that if we don't take care of our bodies, you know, from the top to the bottom down, everything else will not be able to follow because we have to maintain, you know, the essence of who we are. And so part of that starts with health. How do we treat ourselves on a daily basis? What is it that we consume that's either going to give us the energy and momentum to keep going, or is it going to, you know, continue to drag us down? A lot of people don't even realize that some of the things that you do consume also impacts your mental health. So I know you have a knack and for retired athletes, right? But I do want to ask you a question before we focus on them more specifically. If there are any correlations between mental health and heart health from the athletic perspective, and I'm asking this question because a lot of people know that February, the month of February, is Black History Month, but people don't realize that February is also Heart Health Month, something I just recently learned. So is there a correlation between mental health and heart health from an athletic perspective?
Well, that's a great question. So it turns out that there is, your body, like you're hinting at, it's all intertwined. So your physical health and your mental health are very, very closely related. You know, anyone who's had the flu will tell you, if you're not feeling well physically, you're not going to feel well emotionally. And it turns out that if you're having heart disease, you know, particularly bad heart disease, like heart failure, or it's hard to exercise, or you have chest pain, you're not exercising that much, you're more likely to be depressed, you're more likely to have anxiety, and it's harder to do the stuff that could lift your spirits, like getting out there and taking walks and going hiking and everything else. So if you don't take care of your heart, it's going to hurt your emotional health for sure.
That makes a lot of sense. So let's move into your niche of retired athletes. Now, having all of that for what you just gave us, keeping that in mind, how can retired athletes take better care of themselves? So we know that technically, if you're retired, you're probably not going to be, you know, doing physical exertion a lot of the time. Some athletes completely step away from any type of exercise whatsoever. So what are some tips you have for retired athletes to take better care of themselves?
Yeah, glad you asked that. So there's a few big ones, and you actually touched on one of them, which is that if you're, and I see this all the time, particularly with football players, but I see it with other athletes as well. When you're playing your sport, you have a certain diet that works for you while you're playing. And usually it's a very, very high calorie, high protein diet. That's what most active athletes eat. The trouble is that when they retire, like you said, you don't tend to work out as much. You're not going to practices. I mean, maybe you're still going to the gym for fun, but it's not nearly the intensity you had during your playing years. You know, you're not out in the field as much. And then on top of that, age, you're getting older, your metabolism slows down. And what I've seen often is that many athletes, they don't change their diet to reflect the fact that they're now not exercising as much and they're older. And so I see that a lot of athletes, they're eating too many calories, too many carbs, too much protein, and they end up struggling with weight. They end up, many of them are overweight, and that causes problems for them. They don't sleep as well. Many of them end up getting sleep apnea. You were talking earlier about heart disease. Many of them will then develop heart disease because of this. The other big health tip for athletes that I like to talk about is that there's a mental health component. And most athletes that I know, they're team oriented. You know, they're teammates or their brothers or their sisters. It's almost like part of a family. And so they're your support network, your coaches, your trainers, the people you're playing with, even the fans, they're part of your support network. And then playing is also part of your identity. If you're a baseball player or a basketball player, most people, that's how you think of yourself. I'm a baseball player. That's what you think of yourself. When you're retired, your world kind of goes topsy-turvy in a way. You have some identity issues. It's hard to figure out, well, I'm not a baseball player anymore or not. You don't have your teammates around. You don't have your coaches around. The media isn't calling you as much. And so that takes a toll on mental health. And I think that athletes need to take steps to protect themselves from that.
I love that. So while you were talking, the word transition came to mind, because most people that I've interviewed who have a special place in their heart for retired athletes, it's all about transitioning. And one thing that you said is that, okay, you're taking in this high calorie intake, because from what I know, you know, I'm not a medically trained doctor, but you want to take in and burn those calories, right, while you're an athlete. And so when the retired athlete transitions from being a full-time athlete to now doing whatever else they're doing post-sports, they haven't transitioned their eating habits, all the things that could cause them a great deal of health issues later. So I definitely love all of what you said, because in the word transition, we have to keep in mind that it's not just about what are we going to do now with the time of our, you know, that fills up our day, but how do we transition from a diet perspective? You know, what you were eating as a 20-year-old, high impact sports, working out maybe 2-3 times a day. Because I know for the football players when I was in college, I think they had 2-a-days and they had weights. So that was about 3 practices. So, yeah, athletes definitely are going to have to make a transition that way, so that it doesn't go into something where now you are dealing with heart disease. I want to ask you a question while we're on this, and it's Black History Month, because I'm a little ignorant to this fact, but I think I've heard before that African Americans have the highest rate of heart disease. Is that true?
It's most likely is true. African Americans tend to have higher rates of heart disease. They have higher rates of high blood pressure, which is something that people often don't think about because it's not very glamorous, but it's very important in terms of your long-term health. And I think a lot of African Americans simply don't get the medical care that they need. And so when you put all that together, it ends up shortening their lives. It ends up increasing their risk of heart attacks and strokes. What I found is that a lot of my former African American athletes, many of them suffer with sleep apnea, which is another thing that, again, we don't talk about that much because it's not that glamorous. But from a health standpoint, it's very important.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's a lot of issues that we need to address that we have not been doing a very good job with. And it certainly is striking retired athletes in general, but I think retired Black athletes in particular, because a lot of them, I don't think, get the health care they need. And we do see a lot of this, particularly with the high blood pressure. It's a very serious and very common problem.
Yeah. And that takes me to the trust factor, because as an athlete, even in college, as an amateur professional player, and then as a pro player, you're in this small bubble, this tight, tight, tight bubble. And there's a huge issue with trust, right? And so for Black athletes dealing with high blood pressure, and some of them may have family history where there was, you know, cholesterol issues, heart problems, diabetes, things like that, I don't think that they are fully aware of the harm they would do to themselves if they are not, I'm going to use the word again, transitioning their diets when they're leaving the sport. And then they're not trusting people enough, like physicians. So I've seen and I've heard about statistics, especially with Black men, not going to the doctor for regular checkups until it's way too late. And then, you know, next thing you know, there's a leg being amputated for diabetes, or there's a massive heart attack or major stroke. But all of these things could have been prevented had there been a focus on your daily lifestyle, what you eat and how you work out, maintain that health, but also ensuring that there is a doctor on board that is giving you the advice on a regular basis so that you can remain healthy. Would you agree?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you actually hit on something that I really like to add on, which is that when you have things like high blood pressure, high cholesterol, things like that, you don't feel it. You know, if your blood pressure is a little high, your blood sugar, it's a little high, your cholesterol is a little high. You don't notice that. It doesn't affect your day-to-day things, your day-to-day activities, until you have a problem. It's fine. Everything's great until you have heart disease or until you have impotence, which is a common problem for men who have chronic high blood pressure. It's all fun and games until you have a stroke. And then by the time these things happen, it's hard to treat stuff once it's already happened. It's much easier to treat it before. And so you're right. If you don't trust the doctor before, you're not going to get your high blood pressure treated because it's not bothering you until it bothers you. You know, and so I agree with you. You need to be able to trust people to treat things that aren't actively causing you symptoms today, because they will cause you problems tomorrow.
Exactly. And that takes me to another point around mental health and depression aspect. So I've heard a lot of athletes talk about the hardest part of their lives is leaving the sport, because that's all they've done for so long and didn't really know what else to do. They didn't know what they were sporting about, you know, and within their lives outside of sports. And that led to depression in a way. And so my question is, what are you seeing, or are you seeing a lot of depression and anxiety among retired athletes? And if so, what can be done about it? What are some small steps that they can start to take now that they can implement into their lives to cut into and hopefully eliminate the depression and anxiety?
Absolutely. And this is actually one of my favorite topics to talk about, because this is a serious problem that doesn't get enough attention. I mean, we just see, even among the general non-athlete population, depression and anxiety has been skyrocketing lately. I think largely because of COVID and economic uncertainty and frankly, just it's hard to see people in person. And, you know, humans are social animals, so it's hard to do that. But I think athletes have a particularly hard time with this because, you know, like we talked about earlier, many of them are team players and now they're not with their team anymore. And as you said, to be an athlete, and I'm not an athlete. I love working with athletes, but you could look at me, I'm not an athlete. But, you know, from what I hear from athletes is most of them, they don't have a plan B throughout their school years and their training years and their playing years. I mean, in other words, if your goal is to be a basketball player and you really want to make it to the NBA, you're not thinking, oh, I could always be an accountant. You know, it's just not like, you know, you can't think that way. You have to think it's NBA or bust, because if you don't have that level of dedication, you're not going to make it. Right.
Yep.
So it's like you burn the, you know, burn the bridges, burn the boats, I guess, and you have to make it. But then, you know, nobody's career lasts forever. And so now you're like, well, what do you do? And so this is a difficult spot that a lot of athletes are in. So and then they're cut off from their support systems because of COVID, and they're not with their team. Yep. So it becomes a very big problem.
You know, and what? So,
yeah.
I'm sorry, I want to dive in really quick for something that you said, because they're cut off from their support system. But sometimes these athletes are the support system, right? And so they have been the ones who've been really fueling the support for their family, their friends, or their business, business activities that they have, or business partnerships, relationships. And now you have, let's go with COVID, but we've been talking about this pandemic, and how that has been cutting into a lot of people's bottom line. That in itself can stack on top of the depression and anxiety that these athletes are already feeling, because now it's like, oh my gosh, how do I've left this sport, I'm not getting this check that I always have gotten before, and all these people are looking at me to do this, do that. You know, how is all of that compounding on the mental health of the retired athlete?
Right. Well, you bring up good points. One of them is there's almost nothing worse than feeling alone, you know, and when you've suddenly switched from being, say, a basketball or football player to now being at home in your apartment, when you can't see your friends, you can't see your family, you're not seeing your team, you don't know what your income is going to be, that will cause anxiety in almost anyone. And we see this as being the case. And then, as you pointed out, a lot of athletes are the support system for their families. And so if people are depending on you, either financially or emotionally, if you're not in a good place, it's very difficult for you to then go and help other people.
Yeah, I agree. I absolutely agree. So what would be your advice to find ways to cut into the depression and eliminate that anxiety, either whether it's you being the main support system for your family, or it's depression where you're really just trying to figure out what your next step is? You know, what advice would you give to the athlete?
Well, I think there's a few pieces of advice I would give. One of them is you need to have some kind of support system. It has to happen. And so one thing you could do is just intentionally reach out to family or friends that have been supportive of you. Okay. We all know this. We all have some people that you can call anytime, day or night, and they're going to support what you're doing and are not going to judge you. And then you've got other people that are either always judging you or they want something.
Exactly.
So you need to figure out who, like, those first group are, the people that will support you, and you need to reach out to those people for support. The second thing I encourage people to do is I'm a big fan of telemedicine, and there's this whole thing now, there's teletherapists. And so what this is you could actually have a psychologist or a therapist or a counselor, and you could meet with them online, you know, with Zoom. And this is a big and it's a growing thing, and it's actually quite easy to arrange this. And so you could develop a support system with a healthcare professional without even leaving your house. And it's not that expensive. And, you know, in my opinion, it's hard to find people you click with for this. So it's relatively easy, I think, to kind of shop around. You could, rather than drag yourself to five different offices, you could meet with a couple of people online and see who fits with your personality, which I think is very important. So I recommend people who have this that they contact an online therapist or psychologist. Other thing is there's a lot of stuff you could do with diet that can improve your mood. Exercise improves your mood for sure. And any athlete will know that, because when they were exercising, they probably felt better. And One last thing I want to add to this is I bet there are a lot of people listening to your show that maybe aren't depressed, but they may have people in their network that are, and yeah. they may not even know it. So I would encourage anyone who's listening to us today, even if you feel great, please reach out to your network and see how they're doing, because maybe the person you haven't spoken to in a while that you just assume everything is okay, maybe they're going through a hard time and maybe they haven't been able to get themselves to reach out to you. And you just making that call or you know, FaceTiming them or even asking them out for coffee or a walk or something like that can make a huge difference in other people's lives. So we want to think about what we can do for our depression, but we also want to reach out to other people, particularly people that you haven't heard from in a while.
Yeah. I really love that. Let me ask you, I want to piggyback just really quickly on this and then we're going to shift gears. But what are, for people who don't know what depression looks like or anxiety, what are some things that they should be on the lookout for themselves as a retired athlete or for their network who they're just checking in on?
Well, the first thing I want to say is for depression or anxiety, this is what trips people up. You don't have to have it every second of the day. So just because you had a good day yesterday, you know, you weren't nervous, or just because you had a lot of fun yesterday, doesn't mean that you don't have depression. So the big myth that people have is if you think, well, if you have good times, sometimes you're not depressed, that isn't true. You could be depressed, but you could still have had a great day yesterday with your, you know, your kids who visited you, for example. So the common things you see with depression, and again, they're not happening all the time, and you don't have to have all of these features. You could just have some of them. But the common things are you feel sad a lot of the time. Your sleep is disrupted. Either you're sleeping a lot more than you used to or a lot less. Your eating is unusual in that either you're eating a lot more than you used to or a lot less. You feel nervous. You're getting angry. Maybe you're not normally an angry person, but you're snapping more easily. We see that a lot with depression. Suicidal thoughts. If you think about killing yourself, you should definitely speak to a mental health practitioner, and that's a strong sign of depression. Feeling hopeless. So most people, you tend to think that tomorrow will be better than today, or at least you could make it better than today. But if you think that tomorrow is going to be worse than today, and you think that a lot, that's the very strong sign of depression.
Okay. Thank you so much for those signs. I know it's very important that not only we become aware of how we're feeling and doing on a daily basis, but also having the knowledge and wherewithal to be able to understand and empathize with other people too. Because sometimes if you just don't know what things look like and what to call it, you know, people are easily brushing it off as though, okay, well, they're just having a bad day. And it could be something way deeper than that. So thank you so much for that advice. I do want to shift gears, though, because you're also a fellow author. All right. So, and you wrote the book, Why Doctors Skip Breakfast. So I want to know what prompted you to write the book and what it is all about.
Yeah. So I'm a physician, and one of my big interests is in this sort of wellness medicine. And I'm a big believer that the day-to-day choices we make, particularly with diet and with sleep and mindset and supplements, those have a big effect on our overall health. And I tend to disagree with a lot of physicians who sort of wait around for people to get sick and just treat it. You know, I think that we can prevent things. And truthfully, where this originally came from, I have a good friend of mine. He's a radiation oncologist. He's a physician, and he treats people with cancer with radiation. And I remember he told me a few years ago, he said, listen, you know, there's this thing called anti-aging medicine. And if you do certain things, you could actually prevent or reverse a lot of the effects of aging. So I heard this and I thought he was full of crap. And he's like, no, I'm telling you, I've known this guy forever. So I thought he was just joking with me. He's like, no, I'm serious. Anti-aging medicine is a real thing. There's like thousands of journal articles about it. Look it up. So I looked it up, and it turns out that there is this whole field now of anti-aging medicine, and it's backed up by a lot of research, and it's all recent. And places like Harvard and MIT and UCLA and USC are doing a lot of the work. And so that's what inspired the book. And the title, Why Doctors Skip Breakfast, really came down to So by training, I'm an anesthesiologist. And one of the things I noticed, I worked at a big sort of academic hospital. We took care of very sick patients. And well, what happened is before surgery, like a lot of the anesthesiologists would kind of sit around at the table and the surgeons would come in and they'd sit around. We'd all be kind of chit-chatting, you know, what we did over the week, you know, like everybody else does. And we'd talk about the cases that are coming up. And I noticed that almost nobody that I was with would eat breakfast. And these would be people that may be going into like 10, 12 hour long surgeries, very complicated things, really grueling days. And very few people ate breakfast. They'd drink coffee, they'd have water, they'd do other stuff, but most of them didn't eat. And so I realized that as doctors, there are many things that we know, like, for example, about intermittent fasting, that we have not done a good job of communicating to other people.
Intermittent fasting. Can you break that down? Because, I mean, I grew up in a spiritual home. I know the idea of fasting, but intermittent, something that you skip, right? You're skipping a portion of the day to fast. So because while you were talking, I was thinking, okay, if you're skipping breakfast, and from an early age, we learned that breakfast is the most important meal of the day, right? So if what is intermittent fasting? And is breakfast the important meal, the most important meal of the day? Is that a myth? You know, like I need some clarification around all of that.
Well, you know, it's funny because you mentioned spirituality, but if you look at most major religions, including Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, fasting is an important component of all of those religions. And, you know, so it's interesting that for thousands of years, important religious texts have emphasized fasting. So people have known about this for a pretty long time. You know, you ask about breakfast. So the whole concept that breakfast is the most important meal of the day, that was invented by this guy, Dr. Kellogg. And you may recognize the name.
Yeah.
He's one of the guys who basically started Kellogg's cereal. And it was, in my opinion, it was probably one of the greatest marketing decisions ever, because this concept that breakfast is the most important meal of the day has lasted for forever. And it was started as sort of a marketing thing for Kellogg cereal, which is kind of a funny story. But intermittent fasting, the idea of intermittent fasting is you go certain periods of time where you're either not eating caloric food or you're eating very little of it. And there's different ways to do it. The most common way, and the way that I do it, and I think the way most fasters do it, is every day or almost every day, you'll go maybe 16 hours or so without eating caloric food. You could still drink water, and you could still have black coffee and black tea and herbal tea, things like that, but you wouldn't eat food. But there's other ways to do it. Like there are these other things, and you'll see this more in religious texts. They have periodic prolonged fasts where maybe once a quarter or something like that, you might go 24 or 36 hours without eating. There's different ways to do it.
Okay.
But these, we think that these are incredibly healthy things to do.
So I just learned something today, and I didn't realize that sometimes I was intermittently fasting in the morning because I would skip breakfast and it comes straight to my computer just with a cup of coffee and work. But sometimes that doesn't work for me because if I'm hungry, my head hurts, you know? But so you said that there is a benefit to it. So what is the benefit? I can see the benefit of skipping the, you know, the calorie filled food in the morning because it's heavy. It may make you tired when you need to be high functioning. Are there any other benefits to this?
Right. So there's a lot, actually. So
the reason why doctors actually skip breakfast and why other people should be skipping breakfast.
Yes. Yes. So I'll tell you. So my book, actually, I wrote most of my book in a fasted state because I found it, and you might have found this too when you're working on your computer, that a lot of people, especially if you're drinking coffee, tend to think more clearly before they eat than after. I mean, we've all had times when we've had a big meal, and then after the meal, you just feel like blah, and you just want to take a nap or something. You don't usually feel that in the morning if you haven't eaten. But you're also correct that it's actually a great way to lose weight. I've had a lot of patients that have tried, they're overweight, and they've tried diet after diet, you know, low carb, low this, low that, and they can't lose weight, or they lose it and it comes back. Mm-hmm. It turns out, and this is surprising, it may not seem this, but this is true for most people. It's actually easier to shrink the amount of time per day you eat than it is mm-hmm. to change what you eat. In other words,
wow.
If I told you you can eat whatever you want, but you only have 6 hours to do it,
mm-hmm.
that would be an 18-hour fast. That would probably be much easier for you, and you would lose more weight than if I said, oh, you can eat whenever you want, but you can only eat certain foods.
Yeah.
So it's actually, for many people, obviously nothing works for everybody. Everybody's different. But for many people, fasting is one of the easiest ways of losing weight. But the reason I'm excited about it is we think it's anti-aging. What it does is we all are born with these, I call them fountain of youth genes or these longevity genes. And, mm-hmm. and intermittent fasting, we think, turns these genes on and actually activates our body's natural systems to live longer and be healthier. I mean, when you think about our ancestors, they were not eating every second of the day.
True.
You know? I mean, our ancestors, especially like hunters and gatherers and people like that, they didn't have a fridge, you know, or processed snacks that they could just grab. So what would happen is you'd go for many hours or maybe even a day or two when you didn't eat anything. And then finally you found an animal that you killed and you ate it, or you didn't really eat anything. And then you found an orange tree or something. And so our ancestors essentially evolved to not be snacking every second of the day. And your body works well that way. And even if you think, and I kind of like this, if you think sort of evolutionarily, when do you want your mental acuity to be sharpest? Imagine, you know, you're existing, this is a long time ago, you're a hunter-gatherer or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
When do you really need to be on your game? If you haven't eaten for a day, and you need to find food, or if you just had a big meal? You know, like, you really need to be on your game if you haven't eaten for a day, because your survival is dependent on your brain at this point.
Right.
You haven't eaten for a day. Like, you need to think and figure out, what am I going to do to eat? And so when you don't eat, that actually kind of beefs up your brain activity. And that makes sense even from an evolutionary standpoint. If you've just killed and eaten that antelope, you know, your brain could, you know, take some time off. You've kind of done what you needed to do.
Yeah. Wow. That's major. You've definitely have schooled me today, because I didn't know all of this. I knew that there was some form of benefit to fasting to give you clarity, you know, just from growing up in a spiritual household. But I didn't know that it had all of these benefits that you have pointed out. But I do want to ask you something, because you said that your colleague was introducing you to basically wellness medicine, and it was one of the things that prompted you to write this book. And you said something about mindset, and you said mindset, and, you know, in the inside of supplements and other things. I'm like, wow, well, mindset it's not like medicine, right? So how does that play a huge part in the picture for you as a doctor and as someone who is really trying to drive home the mental well-being of retired athletes?
So I'll tell you, you know, I'm one of these like very evidence-based people. And you tell me stuff, my natural instinct is to argue with you. My parents tell me I should have been a lawyer.
Yes.
So my instinct is to argue. And so for years, you know, people say like gratitude, you know, mindfulness. I'm like, whatever, you know, like, you know, I'm sure it's nice, but, you know, that's just the touchy-feely thing.
Right.
But what I found is there's actually quite a bit of research to support these things in terms of mental health. But oddly enough, there's a lot of research to support them in terms of physical health and even aging. So there's a thing, I don't have to go into the details of it, but they're called telomeres. And when you could look at cells under a microscope and you could measure their telomeres, and it's a sign of how old your cells are. And so I could take some of your cells, we could look at them under a microscope, and we get a sense of how old they are. Now, it turns out that when you have mindfulness practices, when you take time, when you have gratitude, when you meditate, when you do these types of things, your cells actually start looking younger under the microscope. Your telomeres actually change in response to these mindfulness practices. So what's exciting for me is you don't just have the kind of mental health benefits. Obviously, it's better. You know, I have kids, and I'm always telling them, do you want to focus on what bothers you, or do you want to focus on what makes you happy? You know, you're better off focusing on what makes you happy. But it turns out that goes all the way down to the cellular level inside your body.
Wow. So that means, so I always hear people say, especially the older people, if you want to die early, stress about everything, right? Because the stress is, like we see it physically, that it's causing people to really age physically, and you're always sick because of the stress and worried about every single thing that's happening in their lives. But people who tend to have more of a positive outlook on life, you know, everything is just always happy-go-lucky. They seem to always have more youthful, joyous appearance. But it really attacks down on a deep cellular level. I never knew that.
Well, I would challenge you. Think about people you know, or listeners. Think about people mm-hmm. you know. How many really? Think of the people you know that are really old. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking like 60, but if you know people like 80s, 90s, 100, how many of those people are bitter, angry people?
Yeah.
Very few. You know, almost all yep. those people, they see the bright side. You know, they're optimistic. Little things make them happy. Like if you visit them, their day totally lights up. And you'll see that. Like very few people that are really old are just sort of angry, bitter, cranky people, you know, because there's something about having a positive mindset that's good for your body.
Yeah. Wow. Doc, you dropped a lot of nuggets on us today. And I think that's a great way to end this show, because we have to make sure that we have a positive mindset in everything that we do. But to have a positive mindset, we also need to make sure that we're taking care of our bodies, and having a mindset is part of that process, right? So don't forget that you can transition from your sport, but you also need to transition your health. Make sure that everything you're doing post-sports is lining up with your health so you can live a long life. And like Dr. Charlotte said, take care of those, what is it, telomere cells?
Yes, exactly.
So you can remain young. Thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a pleasure to host you. I mean, definitely, it's just been a wealth of knowledge, some things that I didn't even know. But that's why we should be always seeking additional education to make ourselves better and to help other people. Where can people follow you and connect with you, Doc?
So I'm very active on LinkedIn. So you can look for me on LinkedIn. I'm on Facebook, and I have a website. The easiest one to find, especially for your athlete listeners, it's called retiredathletehealth.com. So you could just look up retiredathletehealth.com. So find me there, or find me on LinkedIn. I'm usually pretty good. If you message me, I'll most likely message you back.
All right. So we're going to put, if you're watching this, we're putting his website and also Retired Athlete Health website into the comment section. If you are listening to this later, make sure that you read the bio notes, because it will have all the links here available for you so you can connect with Dr. Gregory Charlotte. Again, thank you so much for coming on the show, guys. I am your host, Savannah Navarro's Protector of Athletes. Make sure you go to the website, Pro Sport Lawyer, and order a copy of our book, What Are You Sporting About? Until next time, you guys have a great day. Ciao.
Thanks for joining us this week on What Are You Sporting About podcast. Make sure to visit our website, prosportlawyer.com, where you can subscribe to the show in iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever your favorite platform is, so you'll never miss a show. And while you're at it, if you found value in the show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes or iHeartRadio. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. If you like the show, you might want to check out our book, What Are You Sporting About? Attorney Savania DeBarros is available for private consulting at sldebarros.com. And remember, we're here to educate, support, and guide you in your journey to success, because we're all sporting about something.